Okay, here we go.
Love Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I'm Karen Tate. Yes, this is me. My voice is still not back to par yet as I'm battling this winter cold. And I'm sorry our music didn't come up for tonight. I had scheduled for you a nice little snippet by Zingaya called Veil of Inanna. So I don't know. I'm wondering if we're in Mercury retrograde yet. I know it was coming. Well, anyhow, with the holidays upon us, I especially wanted to thank you for tuning in during what might be a really busy time for you. So whether you're catching us live tonight or if you catch us from the archives, thank you. Thank you very much. And please, as I like to remind you, please remember the three F's. I would love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. That's the first F. Also, be sure to become our friend. That's the second F. And also, and click follow, the third F, so that you never miss notice of any of my new guests each week. That way, you're a regular part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And you find all of those three F's on my show page right there at Blog Talk. Well, tonight we have a wonderful guest for you. Her name is Jerry Studebaker, and her book we're going to discuss is Switching to Goddess. We're going to be talking about what she means when we say most of the major world gods or war gods, why some of her goddess community friends might have been angry with her for writing a book intolerant of Christianity, and what the world was like when most of the world actually revolved around female deity. You know, we're going to get into Jerry's opinion of academics who've poo-pooed the notion that old Europe and other Neolithic and early Bronze Age people worship primarily goddesses. We'll discuss if humans are incapable of living without war. And maybe most important, how do we accomplish the shift to goddess? How do we switch our society, our culture, and religions to the old guiding goddesses? But before we start our interview, just a short bit of housekeeping. I want to mention again that there is a link on my website that takes you to the itinerary for the sacred tour I'll be leading to Turkey, Land of the Nourishing Mothers, next November. I'm taking both men and women on the trip, as I always do. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Şatılhöyük, Side, and Lagana, where we find Hecate's only standing temple known to modern man. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations, rituals at the site, Turkish baths. We'll partake of mineral springs near the domain of Aphrodite outside her temple at Aphrodisias, and lots of other good stuff. So if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey, maybe you want to satisfy your mind, your body, or your soul, check out my website at KarenTate.com. People are already signing up for next November, so if you'd like to give yourself something meaningful, maybe as a gift for the holidays, a promise of a spiritual journey soon to come with other like-minded folks who'll be drinking in the essence of the mother in her many forms and faces, don't hesitate to sign on for the tour, because, you know, we're only taking 20 people, and there's been a good response early, so I don't have any doubt it's going to fill up before next November. And while you're at KarenTate.com, might I invite the influx of new listeners to the show to check out my two books, which have actually garnered some prestigious endorsements and awards, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and Walking in Ancient Paths. Those are the two titles. They're kind of like bookends. The first one, Sacred Places, well, it tells you how to get to these sacred places around the globe if you're actually a traveler and have a passport and don't mind that long plane flight across the pond. But if you're more the armchair tourist, well, many reviews have been pretty outstanding as people feel the book sort of takes them there. Sacred Places of Goddess is sold everywhere, even in museum bookstores. And the second book, Walking Ancient Paths, well, it was a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Books Awards. I kind of think of it as a spiritual socio-political look at embracing goddess, whether she be deity the archetype or ideal, how you can actually fit the great she into your life and community. It's an easy read. It's not one of these ones that your eyes are going to glaze over because it's full of academia. Lots of practical stuff that talks about what the community I lived in for 20 years did to embrace Goddess and make her a part of our lives. It's also sold everywhere. And if you like, you can take advantage of a special I have for my listeners. Both books are $25 plus shipping and handling, and I'll sign them for you. Again, not a bad idea for a holiday gift for yourself or your loved one. And, I believe in freebies. Those are also on my website at KarenTate.com. I feel I'm in service to you, helping minister Goddess's children. Check out the free meditations and the all-occasion Goddess gift cards and other interesting offerings on the Goddess store page at KarenTate.com. So don't forget, if you're listening live and want to call in and talk to my fabulous guest or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a natural lapse in the conversation, and I'll invite you to give your comment or question, and I'll identify you by your area code. And if there's time after this interview with Jerry, I might be able to fit in a What's the Buzz segment, where I talk about those blasted bees buzzing around in my bonnet, those bees that represent the Goddess ideals out there that are either being trampled on or perhaps being embraced. Kind of really depends on if my voice holds out tonight. So let's not delay any further because we have a lot to get to. I'll start with telling you a little bit more about Jerry Studebaker. She holds a master's degree in prehistory archaeology. She finished a thesis on the origins of agriculture in the Middle East and completed the coursework for a PhD in cultural anthropology. She taught undergraduate courses in archaeology, cultural anthropology, and physical anthropology at The Ohio State University. She's published articles on goddess history and spirituality in Pangaea, Sage Woman, and Major Focus. In 2003, she spent a month on the island of Crete studying ancient Minoan art, and she's currently putting the final touches on a mystery sci-fi novel titled Minoan Time Traveler. That sounds provocative. Switching to Goddess, her book we're talking about tonight is filled with tons of minute facts that we need to get a handle on again to make the case for switching over to Goddess. So let's actually start doing that right now. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I am so glad to have you. This is long, long overdue, and I am just so glad you're finally here now.
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, when you're saying switching to Goddess, maybe for some listeners out there who might sort of be new to this, why don't you explain that a little bit?
Well, in a nutshell, I'm saying that in order to survive, the human species needs to trade in its war gods for its old peace gods and goddesses. Today, almost all deities in the industrialized nations are violent war deities, and this rise in war gods is a process that began thousands of years ago and has just gotten worse and worse through time. Some examples of war deities are Jehovah, Allah, the Hindu god Indra, Mars, Aries, Odin, and Tyr, and many, many others. I'm also saying that before around 4000 BC, there were no signs of war gods anywhere on the planet, as far as we can tell. And also, we can't really see any signs of institutionalized warfare anywhere before 4000 BC. And by institutionalized warfare, I mean war that's built into the system, into the social system, like what we have now, where we don't just fight war, we fight war just about every decade. We've fought wars in this country, and our ancestors in Europe, same thing.
Well, you know, Jerry, when you think about it, I mean, look, we have on YouTube clips, you know, George Bush talking about war is good for the economy. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's really, it seems like we go to war pretty frivolously.
Yes.
You know, when people in this country are really doing so well, you know, that they have to be so greedy that they would make war a way of life so that rich people can get richer and spill the blood of the poor and the middle class who actually fight the wars. It's really pretty pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And unfortunately, George Bush is right. War is good for the economy. And that's just one of the factors that keep it going in our society and in other industrialized societies around the world. But I think the core, the deep core, has to do with the fact that our religions revolve around deities who revolve around war, and also something that I might get into later called starvation culture. So those two things. I don't think we'll ever get rid of war until we look at the deep underlying causes for
why. Or we stop making it profitable. You know,
yes.
If we made it more profitable to be at peace, you know, and I'm not an economist, I'm not sure how we could structure that, but if we made it
mm-hmm.
more profitable to be at peace, then maybe war would become a thing of the past. It's a sad state, isn't it?
It is a sad state, absolutely. Yes.
Well, you know, as you talk about the war gods, it reminds me. I was teaching this year a class, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and in the second mm-hmm. part of the class, they get into Sarah. Sarah's voice, and it brings in Yahweh and how Yahweh wanted, I think it was it Abraham to go sacrifice his son up on the mountain. And, you know, and we just stopped for a minute and analyzed Yahweh, and we thought, God, would you want, well, sorry about that, but would you want this person, Yahweh, as your neighbor or your friend or your husband or your brother or your father, much less your God? You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
when you really look at the personality, you know, involved,
mm-hmm.
the things that he, you know, sort of manipulates people to do or gives people license to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, you got to stop and think, is that the kind of God you want people looking up to all around the world?
Exactly. And as we speak, 33% of the world claim that they follow Jehovah as their major God, major deity. And Jehovah just comes right out and says, I am a warrior. The Lord, well, Exodus 15:3 says verbatim, the Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. So Jehovah's not trying to hide the fact that he's a war god. The Bible mentions war or warriors or warfare over 300 times. Most ministers, Christian ministers, don't seem to want to talk about that, but it is a fact. And peace is mentioned often, too, but if you have both war and peace in your rule book for living, that kind of makes for a schizophrenic type of approach to life.
It sure does. Well, you know, and there's so much that's in the Bible that we sort of just gloss over, and it's sort of institutionalized license to demean women as well.
Oh, yes. Exactly.
And I mean, I can't tell you the conversations I've had with people that don't even get that. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's just hard for them to even comprehend. You know, I think these things, you know, this demeaning of women, this even bigger subject of war versus peace, you know, we've become desensitized. You know,
mm-hmm.
it just mm-hmm. has become a way of life, which, you know, it seems like a good segue to, you know, are humans born to make war? Is it really in our genes? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a big battle that's going on in academia. Are humans born to do war? And Keith Otterbein, who's he's an anthropologist from University down in Texas, has written a book all about war and where it came from, and he talks about the fact that there's a war on about war in academia, and there are two sides, the hawks and the doves, and the hawks say, yes, the war is built into our systems, and the doves say, no, there's no way it can be. And it's very hard for me to understand the arguments that the hawks make, because one of the basic facts here is that there are peaceful societies existing right now in the world.
Right.
Societies that do not make war, and if war is in our genes, if it's something we're genetically pushed to do, yeah, we would not have these peaceful societies in the world.
Well, I mean, that's the old nature-nurture question, isn't it? In a way, maybe. And I don't know. It would be interesting to see how the hawks and the doves line up. What spirituality do they come from? That would be an interesting, I'd like to be a fly on the wall,
you know,
or just take a poll and see what religion the hawks belong to and what religions the doves belong to. That in itself may be, quite revealing.
Uh-huh. Yes. Definitely. I don't know. It seems like a lot of academics are, well, who knows what their religion is. Some are atheists, some are belong to all kinds of other religions. But you talked about nature versus nurture. And to me, as an anthropologist, that was my main area of study. Human beings, unlike all other animals, we aren't born with instincts. Other animals are born knowing how to make their nests, how to find food at age 3 months, 4 months. But humans are born just almost completely blank slates. That's why it takes us so long to become adults. And so the only thing we have going for us is culture, which is our training that we get from our parents and our society about how to do everything, think about everything. And so you can train a human being to be and do about anything. So that's why you get societies like the Samai, who are so peaceful and nonviolent that if you talk about hitting someone among the Samai, it causes them to be just as horrified as if you talk about killing someone.
Yeah.
That's how nonviolent they are. And it's simply, they're human beings like you, me. If they would have grown up in North America, they would have been just like you and me. But they grew up in this culture that taught them that violence is absolutely off the board.
Well, I think I'm leaning toward the nurture. It's how we raise our kids. I don't think it's in our genes.
Mm-mm. No, I don't think so. You also there are scores of books that have been written about the past in societies that just didn't do war. I mean, prehistoric societies, especially back in the Neolithic, it's very clear in the archaeological record to see whether or not a society fought wars or not. I mean, you see it in the skeletal, the bones that remain. You see it in the art that the people made. They make war art. If they did war, they make war art. You see warriors buried with their weapons in their graves.
Well, Jerry, let me ask you this. Recently I was at a conference and we were talking about in the beginning, when man was is still in the Neolithic times, it was more the we, us, sort of the community mentality. You know, it took maybe the tribe to take down the mastodon to feed the village. And then the rational mind kicks in and, you know, the dying rising king doesn't want to sacrifice for the fertility of the crops and the people anymore. And it starts to be this I, me mentality. It makes sense to me, and I'm not an anthropologist, but it makes sense to me if you make that shift from being about the big picture, the community, to I, me, well then, you know, I, me is entitled to kill you because maybe you have something I want or something I need, and, you know, us sort of disappears. We're not in it in a partnership anymore.
Mm,
you know,
right.
we're in the survival of the fittest mode.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when the shift happened?
Yes, that's when it happened. Absolutely. Throughout switching to goddess, I talk about the year, the time 4000 BC, give or take a few hundred years either side, depending on where you are. 4000 BC being the watershed date. Before 4000 BC, you see, when I looked at the five areas that I chose to study in switching to goddess, you see goddess at the center of things, and no war, no violence, no hierarchy. And after 4000 BC, that's when you begin to see the rise of the I-me, as you put it, the rise of the war gods. And I think what happened, and I'm not the only person saying this, is something that I call starvation culture, and it arose around 4000 BC because the world went through a massive drought that led to massive world starvation, and the starvation behaviors that starving people go through were kind of solidified at one point, and I think that's where this I-me stuff comes from. It's where war comes from. It's where hierarchy comes from.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, just to give us a sense, what's happening in the world at 4000 BC? What cultures are around then? Is that the Mesopotamian culture?
Let's see. 4000 BC is the beginning of the Mesopotamian cultures, yes. It is the beginning of the first, what used to be called the cradle of civilization, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in the Near East. It's a little bit after old Europe, and it's, before Minoan Crete. But it's basically, the big thing that happened was there was a big shift in population. Most people think because of a huge drought that covered a fourth of the world's land surface. And it's also the rise of the state. I don't know if you remember ever reading about the rise of the state, but
so we're talking about King Sargon and all of that sort of. Is that what you mean by the rise of the state?
Yes, I mean the first city states where people are packed into cities around with huge 15-foot walls around them, and you first get slavery, you first get strongman rule, you get intense poverty of some, and then immense wealth at the other end. All the things we dislike about ourselves just kind of shot up overnight around that time period in what we used to call a great thing, the rise of the first civilization. But we now know, archaeologists are beginning to say, this was not a great thing. This was the beginning of a lot of things we dislike about ourselves.
It's almost as if civilization breeds this I-me dominator culture, and we get out of the, thinking of ourselves as, you know, what we say today, the global family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And again, there is so much about Western civilization that is so weird and so counterintuitive, Karen. I mean, for example, why do we dislike women? Who are the source of all of us. And sometimes mothers kind of appear even at the bottom of the totem pole within the category of women, and they're the real source of all of us. And why do we seem to love pain and hate pleasure? I mean, our religions teach us that the most sex is bad, and we do ritual flagellation, and we talk about no gain without pain.
We're pretty sick.
Yeah.
Almost like we need psychiatrists for our culture.
Yes.
Our culture needs to go to a shrink.
Yes.
You know what I've always thought, and I don't know if there's an actual basis for this, but, you know, it just intuitively I have felt that if in the beginning we had goddess, and by association, you know, women had a higher status because they were looked at as the life givers, you know, they could give life like goddess provided all that we needed for life. They could bleed without dying, that whole thing.
Right.
I just wonder if it was simply a matter of, you know, man didn't want to have, you know, allow women to stay on top, you know, and I'm not talking about the sexual position, you know.
I'm
thinking, they didn't want to, maybe they perceive themselves as second class. I mean, now we know that our, you know, matrilineal or matriarchal societies, you know, women were not in control. They were more egalitarian societies, so I wouldn't think the men had it so bad. It wasn't as if women were oppressing them. I just wonder if, you know, they were tired, you know, they wanted the power that they saw the women had in their hands, and if it was really the first gender wars.
Well, that could be, but what I talk about in switching to goddess is that one thing that, to me, explains all the weirdness and counterintuitive stuff that goes on is this idea of we are descended from starving people. I mean, it's long starving people, and we know this because we've done studies on them. Social bonds are broken down within long starving groups, and the last to be broken is the mother-child bond, but eventually that bond too is broken, and mothers begin to mistreat and abandon their children. And I think we have a cultural memory of that, and that could
so
be one reason.
So it's like we're carrying this memory in our DNA, and we're still responding to it?
That's right. Well, it's a little bit more complex, and if we have time, I'll get into that. But why we love pain and hate pleasure, maybe because our long-starving ancestors lost interest in all pleasures in life, and we know that's the case with long-starving people. We've studied them. And also, almost everything about their lives is painful. Why do we hoard things?
What stops us from saying, look, you know, we're intelligent thinking human beings. Let's shift gears here. Now, I mean, even if that doesn't mean switching to goddess, okay? Because, I mean, you know, I've even said that to people. Look, if our society could change and be a society that we talk about, you know, in terms of embracing goddess ideals, if we can't quite get to the point where, you know, we're calling, you know, what we're doing, sacred feminine ideals, or, you know, we don't truly have goddess at the center, but we do have a caring culture again, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that would sort of be an adequate compromise, you know, to uplift, you know, humanity. But I guess I just wonder, you know, from an anthropological point of view, why can't we, like, reprogram ourselves? Why can't we look at this horrible behavior and see it for what it is? Or is it just too many people getting rich off of it?
Well, you know, I think that it's like psychotherapy. One of the ways psychotherapists help us understand our own personal behavior and which part of it is a problem for us is by helping us look to see what's going on under the surface within our own lives. And I think, personally, the problem is we don't understand that it might be something like the starvation culture that's causing us most of the things we hate about ourselves. I mean, why do we hoard? Why do we overeat to the point of illness, many of us?
Right.
Why do
right.
we go to war perpetually? Because people who starve, they steal constantly from brothers from sisters, husbands from wives. What is war other than a large-scale kind of stealing?
Right.
Abuse.
Right.
Abuse. Long-starving people, the Tuso of Africa were starving for a long time, and the elderly couldn't even stand and walk. They were skeletal people who had to crawl, and younger people would, the elderly people tried to get up, the younger kids would push them down again and laugh. It's very psychotic type behavior. And I think that most of the people who went through this kind of starvation back around 4000 BC over this huge expanse of land, one-fourth of the world's land surface. Most of them died out, but the few who survived, even when they got to lots of food again, maybe an oasis, carried this kind of psychotic behavior as a permanent culture, and they kept handing it down from their children to their children's children and so forth. And and then these people, I think, and I'm not the only person who, this isn't totally my theory, Heide Gertner-Abendroth, the German culture historian, and also a writer on goddess
issues.
Yeah,
I've had her on the show, actually.
Have you? Yeah.
Yeah,
she talks about this theory, too. She thinks it makes a lot of sense. And she talks about it as the rise of patriarchy. Where did patriarchy come from?
Right. Well, now, when you're out teaching, do you have, I'm asking for a barometer check. Do you have a lot of people that believe this idea of goddess and these things we're talking about, or do you find that there's still a lot of resistance to it?
Well, there's still a lot of resistance within academia, if that's what you mean. There's a horrendous resistance in academia, and it's so strong and virulent that it's suspicious. I mean, academics, and especially feminist academics, get so angry when they talk about prehistoric female deity that it just feels kind of like something's wrong. The lady doth protest too much, or what is that phrase? I forget what it is.
So are we saying the feminist scholars are in favor of these theories, or they're also fighting these theories?
They're fighting the theories.
They're fighting the theories.
They are fighting the theories. And I think it has to do with quite a few things. You probably know that during the most of the 1800s and 1900s, our best mind said that throughout prehistory, people worshipped goddesses.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew that. No.
Yeah. Eric Newman wrote, The Great Mother, and Riffaut, a French academician, wrote The Mothers. And, yeah, that was the accepted theory, that people in prehistory worshipped goddesses. But these mostly male academics also said that when we got smart around 4000 BC, we started worshipping gods.
So we got smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the way we're living right now is smart.
Yeah, right.
What a joke.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was fine as long as the goddesses weren't a very smart thing to do. It was fine to think that we worshipped them then. But then it was in the 1980s that you started getting Marija Gimbutas and Rhianna Eisler and the other mostly women writing about the fact that, it probably wasn't a smart thing to move from goddesses to gods. It was a bad thing because life was, pretty good in a lot of ways back then, especially compared to the rise of the state, when you get the first big institutionalized war and slavery and cruelty. And then, bam, almost overnight, academia did an about-face and sorry, we were wrong. There's no such thing as prehistoric goddesses. And
well, how could they go back on it then? I mean, could they, if they had evidence for it, which I assume they did, what could make them change their mind? How could, did they suddenly find what they claimed was new evidence? Or they just changed their opinion?
Not really. I find it very difficult to understand what most of these writers are saying. And, one of the biggest critics is Lynn Meskel. Cynthia Eller is another. And what they do mostly is talk about, they take goddess art, goddess figurines from prehistory, and there are tons of goddess
figurines.
Tell
the Venuses.
Yes, the Venuses from the Paleolithic and in the Neolithic. There are so many otherworldly female figurines in Neolithic archaeology sites that in some places archaeologists have to cart them away in wheelbarrows. There are
right.
so many.
Right.
So what these academics are doing today is they come up with lists of all the things that these figurines could be other than goddesses.
Oh, so. Like the Barbie doll theory, the ancient Barbie
yeah.
doll. Well, now let me ask you this, and I realize I'm, you know, it's hard to maybe sort of explain the backstory, but you might have just enlightened me on something that I found very confusing. I don't know whether you may have heard one of my guests on the show, who's been on the show a number of times. His name is David Hillman. He's a PhD, and he wrote a book called The Chemical Muse, and the content of the book, The Chemical Muse, exists because they would not allow him to put that information in his thesis because, you know, the people in his thesis committee said that even though he could back it up with, you know, academic proof, it went against sort of the traditional ideas that, you know, he was saying that there was casual drug use in the ancient world, and they it was almost as if they didn't want that coming out or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, he and I sort of struck up a friendship because I found him so interesting because he could actually translate all the old Greek texts himself. He didn't have to, you know, rely on other people's translations, which he felt were very distorted because so many of these people were looking through a Christian lens. Well, now where I'm going with this, it's kind of circuitous, but where I'm going with this is he really ruffled a lot of feminist feathers because he was saying stuff like, women, I love you women, I am an advocate for you women, but you got to get over this idea that women in the ancient world were all subjugated and oppressed. There were lots and lots of powerful women. And he would cite all of these, you know, like, for instance, the, you know, the oracles at Delphi and different people like this. You know, he said the ancient priestesses were the last line of defense against Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And he made so many enemies among the feminists simply because he told the feminists, look, don't rely on these translations that are coming to you, you know, through somebody who's translating through a Christian lens. Look through, you know, learn to read it yourself, or go through somebody who doesn't have this tainted view, and you will find that, you know, there was a time. I mean, you know, it wasn't that bad for women. The, you know, the picture you're painting maybe wasn't that grim. You know, you have a lot more to be proud of than you seem to want to claim. And they just ripped him to shreds. And I'm wondering if what you're talking about and what I saw happen with him, if there's any correlation, you know?
Well, you know, I hate to tear academics down because they have an important job to do, and many of them are doing doing us huge favors by doing the work they're doing, but I do have to wonder, it seems to me that especially feminist academics have just gotten a seat at the academic power table. They've just kind of been accepted, and I think they're going overboard trying to keep that seat, if you see what I mean.
Trying to be one of the boys.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like we often, so often see happens to women when they go to Congress, you know, sort of the Margaret Thatcher or Sarah Palin kind of woman kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, God, what a horrible thing to say.
Because,
I mean, look, I know some of these women work tirelessly, you know, for very little reward. And, you know, and I don't want to sound like I'm dishonoring their work. But, you know, I'm more interested in truth and authenticity. You know, I mean, I want to know what we think really happened using the best possible information at our disposal. You know, I don't want it tainted through a Christian lens or a male lens or, you know, an oppressed woman's lens. You know, I just want to know the most accurate information we can put our hands on.
Right, yeah. Well, I definitely think that what academia is saying about prehistoric goddesses is very, very wrong. And I think there's a lot of politics going on and fear. There's money involved. I mean, academics depend on the powerful to give them money to do their research and to excavate. And, you know, Chattahoochee, the excavator at Chattahoochee, Ian Hodder.
Ian Hodder, yeah.
Yeah. I could not believe what I saw when I went to the Chattahoochee website not long ago. The major, two of the three major funders of that excavation is Shell Oil and Boeing Corporation. Two of the largest corporations in the world are financing the excavation at that site, which is one of the major goddess sites. And I find it very interesting that Ian Hodder can barely say the word goddess. He just is so careful to skirt around that word.
And that's really sad. Are we going, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but my mind is clicking here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so are we saying that these corporations maybe take more of the, say, conservative view, the Judeo-Christian
mm-hmm.
view, and they're not going to keep funding things if
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, if it's not, you know, if it doesn't fall in line, so to speak.
Right. I think that the big powers in the world know that they hate the idea of goddess and utopia mixed together. They were fine with just goddess in the Neolithic. But when you say when we had goddess, we also had lives that were idyllic,
mm-hmm.
then I think the powers that be are afraid if people really understood that people would abandon war gods and war and working themselves into an early grave to keep Shell Oil going.
Right.
So,
wow.
Boeing Corporation.
You know, when you look at it like this, I mean, this is it really sort of takes on a different dimension, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah.
not like we're just talking about, you know, embracing goddess. I mean, we're seriously talking about potentially annoying, and I guess that's probably a gentle word, threatening, annoying, whatever we're going to say. You know, people like them, people who have an
mm-hmm.
awful lot of money.
Mm. Boeing builds airplanes for military defense. They don't
yeah.
want war to go away.
Right.
They don't want war to go away. And I am convinced that if people really could see the evidence for goddess utopia, that it would really start turning people around. And
right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? However it goes, I'm proud to be one of her torch carriers.
Yes.
You know, I mean, at least we're trying to awaken the masses here. And you know, in your book, I mean, I'm so glad for, you know, your book being out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's just sort of segue a little bit. Now, you said that you got some flack in the goddess community for writing a book that, you know, I'm sort of scratching my head. Why do people
mm-hmm.
in the goddess community care if you seemed intolerant of Christianity? I mean, Christianity is, you know, an institution, you know, it's like institutionalized sexism and discrimination. Why did they
yeah.
care for if you spoke the truth about that?
I think that one person just really came out and said, we're afraid that your book will turn Christians away from the goddess movement. And just like feminists just getting a seat at the table in academia, the goddess movement is just beginning to get a seat at the Christian power table. And I think that some Christians are Christian goddess people, women, men, think that they're going to be rejected along with me and the entire movement if they seem to accept my switching to goddess. But like you,
You know, I can agree with that, but only to a point. You know, I mean, I think it's in how it's handled. I mean, for instance, you know, for years I have done an ISIS birthday tea to honor ISIS every July because her birthday is in July. Now, I know a lot of progressive Christians who are Mary Magdalene people, and when I realized Mary Magdalene's birthday was also in July, we turned it into the ISIS Mary Magdalene birthday salon and tea, you know, and I mean, it seemed perfect to me. I mean, we're building bridges, it's common ground, because, you know, I'm looking at this as archetypes, quite frankly. You know, I'm looking at Jesus and Mary Magdalene as the divine feminine, sacred masculine, just like Isis and Osiris is the same thing. We're just calling them different names, right? So, you know, that seems very logical to me, and I'm sure that I might not agree with, some of these maybe progressive Christian women across the table, say, for instance, maybe on abortion, okay? I will never believe you should take rights away from women, because then they're a slave to their reproductive cycle, you know? But, you know, we may not agree on that, but there's so many other things we can agree on. So why subterfuge? Why lie that, you know, I mean, look, Jimmy Carter even left the church saying discrimination is a sin. I mean, it's like when, and Desmond Tutu and the elders, I mean, so many people are coming out and saying that now. That sounds like a dinosaur position, you know what I mean, to put you in that position. I don't think that was very forward-thinking, quite frankly. I mean, it's not like, I'm sure you weren't being rude or abusive. I mean, but how can we not say that Christianity thwarts women?
Yeah, right. And in my opinion, helps keep institutionalized war going.
Yeah, institutionalized war, sexism, discrimination.
Right.
I mean, you know, what's more important? You know, I don't know. I'm sorry you had to. I'm sorry you had to endure that. But you know what? I understand it, and I'm sure there are more people that think the way this person who gave you a hard time thinks, because, you know, I used to be on this listserv. It was for goddess people and Christians, and I presume they were progressive Christians if we were all on the same list, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And everybody seemed to get along fine until Sarah Palin hit the stage.
Really?
And when Sarah Palin comes along, well, it was like everybody was at each other's throats. Suddenly, the progressive Christians were discriminating against the goddess women on the list because, you know, the goddess women were more feminist-oriented. You know, they were taking the Eve Ensler, Gloria Steinem position that this woman is dangerous. She is not somebody we should be getting behind.
Yeah.
You know, she's a tool of the patriarchy. You know, this isn't about support any one a woman at all costs, you know. They couldn't get that. You know, they were sucked in by her charisma.
Yeah.
I think, but I know she has been a divisive component, I think, that has also separated maybe some Christians from goddess people as well. I just find that kind of interesting. You know, because a lot of the folks, you know, the Christians on that list, even when confronted with that YouTube clip that her church was at war with the Queen of Heaven, the goddess, you know, they still couldn't say, you know what, maybe we really need to rethink her. You know, it's like everything they had said up to that point about embracing goddess, it was so easy to throw it out the window.
I think that, who was it? Sam Harris, I think. There have been several books lately on the bestseller list about the dangers of Christianity and the dangers of moderate Christians, who I know moderate Christians. Many of my family are moderate Christians. They are lovely people. They're just lovely people. But they are preserving a book, in my opinion, that is very bloody. It's very, very dangerous. And these Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, Chris Hedges, they're writing along the same lines now, and a lot of people are reading their books. And I think what happens is good people have been sucked into the Old Testament, New Testament Christian Bible, and the New Testament isn't so bad with Jesus, and the Mary part is great, but that Old Testament is just full of things that you would never want to talk to your kids about. There's a website that I talk about in my book called the I put it in my book. There are 20 pages full of really awful things in the Bible about tearing people's arms off mothers eating their children and just horrible, violent things that you know, Christians don't, they skip over those parts, but they are there. And I think when times get tough or when people aren't thinking clearly, like they weren't on your listserv, then people kind of gravitate back to the nasty stuff in the Old Testament.
Yeah. And going back to what you said about the moderates are dangerous, I think the moderates are dangerous because of their silence. And maybe
mm-hmm.
they're saying the
yep.
same thing. But, you know, it's almost like whether we're talking Islam or we're talking Christianity, and look, and I'll be the first to say I think there's some pagan fundamentalists too, okay? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I want to be equal opportunity whistleblower here.
Yeah.
You know, I think if the moderates don't speak up and they let the extremists set the tone, then, you know, they're guilty by their silence almost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Right.
And I think that's that's really a dangerous thing because I don't know what that is. Because they are being hijacked along with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't know why they're comfortable with that, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess we're getting a bit sidetracked there, but it's interesting. Let me ask you this, too. And do you go as far back in your book as the Acheulean goddess?
Old Europe. Right? Is that Acheulean? No, that's the Paleolithic, I think. Yes, I don't go that far. I start
okay.
with the Neolithic, which is the time period when people first settled down into settled villages, started
okay.
planting
well,
their food.
The Acheulean goddess, that is the easiest place to find a picture, I think, of that artifact or those reproductions on that in that magazine called Sacred Source, and it's one of the most crude Venuses you'll see. So it's almost like the ram something. excuse me. I can't remember. I think it's called the ram cat or something like that. Image from it might be from the Levant or something like that. But I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that, because some people say no, this was just an original piece, the first piece of art potentially, and maybe it was a goddess. And other people think, well, maybe it was naturally occurring. But I just can't imagine that it was naturally occurring, because it's sort of crudely resembles at least the torso of the Willendorf, you know, with maybe two breasts and a lower part of the body. But anyway, so tell me, let's switch over to the academics that have sort of poo-pooed the notion that old Europe worshipped primarily goddesses. Is this still the Ian Hodder stuff, or is there more to that? Because, there were ancient, like the fish goddess. I'm still seeing that artifact from Maria Gimbutas' book.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the oldest settlements along the Danube or something was like 6,000 years old, and we have the fish goddess Lipinski Veer, I think.
Yeah,
was where it is. So can you speak a little bit to that, or any what you wanted to comment on about that?
You mean about academics thinking there weren't goddesses in old Europe, or that?
Yeah, or was that what you were saying about they're hauling them off in wheelbarrows and still denying that people were worshiping goddess?
Well, that was part of it, but I can talk more. I definitely can talk more about why I think there are goddesses. That goddesses were the center of things back in many areas in the world in prehistory. And could I just say here that for some people who might not know this, prehistory is the time before we have written records for people. So in switching to goddess, I take five world areas in prehistory and look just at them. They all seem to center around goddesses, and three of them were in the Neolithic, which is the time period when people didn't have metal yet, and they had just settled down and started growing crops instead of hunting for their food. Now I've lost my train of thought.
you were talking about what prehistory is, what that time period represents.
Yes. I've lost that point. Let me go on to another reason why I think these academics are wrong. When the people in my five prehistoric areas finally get writing, or when we can translate their writing, they say these figurines represent goddesses. So, and even the harshest critics, Lynn Meskel, Cynthia Eller, for example, will admit that, yeah, probably, even though there are scores of other things the goddess or female figurines could represent, they probably represent female deity. But you have to read through maybe 30 pages of an article by Lynn Meskel, who's an archaeologist or anthropologist, I think, 30 pages, and maybe on page 28 there's one little line where she admits that, because she's so shrill about wanting to protest against the idea that there could be goddesses in prehistory that she finds it very hard to be really open about it. So she hides these little comments in the back of her papers.
And you wonder, again, I keep going back to this, and maybe it's not fair, but I would really want to, I mean, it's like when you see a documentary on television, you want to know who financed it to see what agenda they are pushing. You know,
sure.
I guess I would like to know what her background is. Does she have a vested interest in, you know, keeping the Judeo-Christian status quo on top?
Interestingly, the area she writes most about is Çatalhöyük, which, as we discussed earlier, the digging there is being financed by Shell Oil and the Boeing Corporation.
I talk a lot, in different ways about lost knowledge, lost history. But, Jerry, I think I'm getting maybe more and more afraid, especially with, the conservatives right now that seem to be coming up all across the globe. You know, I guess I'm afraid 50 years from now, unless we have some sort of resurgence or enlightenment, I wonder if our great-great-granddaughters are going to know about this, or if it's going to be swept under the rug again.
Well, I think that it's going to take people like you, Karen, and me and other people who are writing, and especially people like you who are reaching out and doing things with the media, your radio station. I mean, it's incredible. It's going to go incredibly far, I think, in terms of getting the word out. And I just think that the idea of female deity and especially mother deity just makes so much sense as a the mother as a symbol for how all of us need to behave toward each other is such an excellent symbol.
Right.
You know, if we can just treat each other the way a healthy mother treats her children,
right,
I don't see that we'd have any trouble in the world whatsoever.
Well, you know, and again, we go back to, you know, there are too many people that are benefiting from things being the way they are, and they're the people who have the influence, you know.
Right.
The have versus the have-nots, you know, and the haves have the power, even though the have-nots, they're more of us.
Yes, right, yeah.
But I'm ready for the revolt. I'm just waiting for somebody to tell me where to go stand in the street. You know, I'll have my sign, and you know, I'm ready.
Well,
where do you think? Where did the war gods? Where did they first come from? Or are they from that Vedic Kurgan culture that Maria Gimbutas talks about, can you just sort of make that clear? Because, you know, I don't know if people understand who Indo-Europeans even are, if that's where you're going to go with this answer.
The first war gods, I think, again, goes back to this drought, this massive drought that happened around 4000 BC. I mean, I doubt if there's ever been a drought. I don't think there ever has been a drought that covered so much land surface as that one did. I mean, it was a quarter of the world's land surface turned from land that was able to feed people to land that absolutely could not. It turned to desert. And it's called Saharasia by at least one person because it starts in the Sahara Desert, and it goes all the way across the Middle East and then all the way across Central Asia to the Pacific. It's huge. And I think that when people starved, they got into ugly starvation behavior, and most groups died out, but some groups made that a permanent way of life, that starvation behavior, where the only thing that was important was taking, eating, finding food, and if you have to... Well, you take it from others. The good man in starvation culture is the man who can con, steal, and lie the best.
Right.
This is
to keep his family fed.
Well, except there is no such thing as the family in long starving groups.
Oh yeah, because you said the mother child bond has broken down too.
First, the husbands go off and fend for themselves and leave the mother and child to fend for themselves. Young kids get together in gangs because their parents don't take care of them anymore. They and the young kids work together to steal food from anyone they can get it from. People run while they're eating so that no one else can take the food away from them.
Oh, it's sad. It's brutal.
It's
brutal.
It's very, very ugly. They're ugly situations, and I think that's where the first war gods came from. Not right away. It was a long, involved process, whereby whereby you have this huge amount of time and huge space, and the only thing that matters to these people is war, taking, and they eventually find the peaceful goddess settlements at the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, where they're still able to grow food, or the Indus River. I mean, not the Indus, the Nile River. And they start taking things from those people, start waging war and taking over their civilization, because these people are peaceful goddess people. They can't defend themselves.
So this is different from the Maria Gimbutas Kurgan invasion idea.
Well, I think that's where the Kurgans came from. I think the Kurgans were just they were these worst starvation culture people. I think that's where the Kurgans came from. That's where the people who settled Mesopotamia, that explains who they were. They were rough, taking, ugly starvation people who conquered the people with all the wealth and the art and the technology, which is what the goddess people had at that time period. And then there became a mixing of these ugly, primitive starvation people who did nothing but take and the refined goddess people. And so, you know, you go back and forth from pure starvation culture people to pure goddess
right.
people, and then mixes. So, yeah, I think that's where I think...
Where this comes from.
That's where war gods came from. Oh,
well,
oh,
and
Karen,
thinking...
here's something that I want to say this because Z Budapest found this probably the most important thing in my book, Switching to Goddess, and that is the idea that starving people in this great, huge Saharasia area felt that the mother goddess, the mother earth, abandoned them.
Ah.
She took away their food, their water, and left them to starve. And then on the other hand, here were their mothers abandoning them. And, you know, there was a mother-child bond at first because you have oxytocin creating that intense mother love, but then the mother shoves them away because she's starving. So it's a double whammy. People have the mother goddess abandoning them, so they turn away from goddess. And what do they turn to? War gods, taking gods.
So,
and their own
and
mothers.
But the earth and the earth abandoned them too because of the climate change.
Exactly. Right.
Well, and you know, I can't help but make the make the link to global warming. You know.
Yeah.
What if you know, it's really true? I read just recently that you know, we still have all the Republican conservative global warming climate deniers, and
right.
really I think they're just shills for the corporations that are afraid they're going to
mm-hmm.
lose money if we actually
so.
Try to do something. I mean, I can they really be that stupid? Well, maybe, but I think they're being paid off too. You know, to not think too deeply. And then you have the people that are just sort of moderately believers, and then you have another group of climatologists who already think it's we passed the point of no return.
Right.
And if they're serious, and you know, in the next I don't really know what time limit they're giving us, 10, 20 years or something, it
mm-hmm.
really makes you and they talk about what potentially could happen to countries if they have a drought, like you're just talking about. We're going to see people crossing borders, and that's going to end up
mm-hmm.
being war, and that's going to be what do you call it, a strain on the resources in these areas where, people are trying to migrate to in order to find food or work or whatever. I mean, I can see where it would be a huge, global disaster, maybe on the level of what you're talking about. You know, it's like history repeating itself.
Yeah, it could be. It's... It's something to think about.
I know we were going to talk about how do we make the shift. I wonder if that helps us make the shift, or would that just push us farther into this starvation, survival of the fittest mode? You know, could at that point we say, look, we've done this before. We have to start doing things differently.
I do mention that, if I remember correctly, in Switching to Goddess, that if things should get really bad because of climate change, overpopulation, whatever, it might be a great way to start over again. And as long as people like you and others of us can get the word out and keep getting it out, people might... In a complete disaster, they might say, "Hey, maybe these people were right. Maybe
we have an alternative."
Yes,
we have an alternative. We don't have to keep doing. Right. Well, you know, mm-hmm. somebody emailed me in this question, and I know it's shifting gears a little bit, but I always try to get, you know, people who have called or emailed, you know, have their questions heard. Somebody wanted to know, do you consider tolerance and acceptance of divergent views a goddess value, and are there any exceptions?
I agree with, I think it was Sam Harris who said that if something is going to harm you and your family and your society, the healthy, normal person will not tolerate that. And the example he uses is societies who haven't figured out the relationship between germ theory and disease. We don't tolerate that kind of thinking if it's going to harm our families or kill us or the people around us. And there are many people now, not just me, who think that the Abrahamic religions, not just Christianity, but Islam and the other war god religions, are driving us to the abyss. It's either Sam Harris or Chris Hedges who use that term. They
mm-hmm.
They think that these Abrahamic war god religions are going a long way toward pushing us to the edge of things.
Right. Well, and how
so
many of them believe in the end times, you know, and they want to mm-hmm. see Jesus. So, you know, they aren't living for long-term goals. You know, they have rather short-term
right.
goals.
That's right. And I have a lot of moderate Christians in my family, but I do have some fundamentalists, and I can see that in them absolutely, that they're not concerned about anything going on in the world because they think it's a sign of the end times, and so there's nothing we can do about it, so why bother?
Right.
I find that very destructive.
Well, you know, when this question came in, I made the assumption that they may have been thinking of, for instance, Sharia law. Because you remember when all the hubbub about do they build the mosque on Ground Zero, and you had
mm-hmm.
one camp saying there were all this Islamophobia, and then you had the other camp, you know, pleading for religious tolerance. And,
yeah.
you know, and there was a big discussion on Facebook about, I had people blast me for religious tolerance and, you know, for Muslims. And I said, look, I don't support Sharia law, but what about all the peaceful, moderate Muslims that don't either? You can't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe, I mean, I think that would go for any faith. If it goes back to the idea what you just said, if they are going to harm other people, well, you know, it wouldn't really matter what their religion are. You know, you can't assault people. You can't kill people. You know, take religion out of the equation. If they're going to do something that's going to harm someone, well, that's not tolerated. But by the same token, I don't think we can go to war because someone is of another faith. I mean, is that a reasonable distinction? What do you think?
I think that ask me that again.
Okay. So all right. So for instance, all right. The question was: do you consider tolerance and acceptance of divergent views a goddess value, and are there exceptions? I would say, and I'm asking if there's a flaw in this thinking, because I would really like to hear your opinion. I would say yes. Tolerance and acceptance of divergent views is a goddess value, because I think diversity and tolerance are goddess values. However, if someone's religion, let's just say, or their job, I mean, what if it wasn't
mm-hmm.
their religion? What if it was their job? What if it was their culture? Said that, you know, they can stone people, they can kill people, they can assault people. Well,
right.
I mean, if you just take religion out of the equation, those things are not acceptable in human society. So,
that's right.
So
yeah.
maybe we can say, yes, of course we can be tolerant of Islam, because all of Islam is not based on that. It's just this extremist, you know, it's just this extremist part of it that we reject. But it's not like we're going to raise an army and go kill these people either. There's no easy answer. At least not one that comes to my mind. I mean, what do you do about Sharia law? It's not like these people are under our jurisdiction that we can really do anything about it. But by the same token, I don't think you start a crusade and you go kill all Muslims because some of them practice the barbaric Sharia law.
Yeah, I think definitely no war. I think we need just to keep talking.
Educating people.
Most people just can't see that their holy books, their gods, are war gods, and that their books are full of negative stuff that is probably what's keeping our war going in the first place.
Right.
I mean, if you have your major role model is a deity who keeps pushing war, kill these people because I say so, go decimate these people, go kill every person in that country because I don't like them.
They're not like us.
Yes, right. They don't listen to me, Jehovah, or me, Allah, so they need all to be killed. And that is
right.
On and on and on. If we need to get people to see, I think, that these books and gods they're following are very dangerous, and I personally think that then they have to, I guess, make the decision about what to do. If they can finally see how dangerous that their religion is and change it in some way to make it not dangerous, then great. But even if they go to non-war gods, like you say, it doesn't have to be goddesses, but even switching to a non-violent god. I mean, there have been several.
We could just go with Jesus.
Yes, that's right.
Jesus or Krishna or somebody like that. Well, you know, this was a big deal on Facebook for a while, and I did take some flack until I said to these people who were usually conservative Christians, I said, look, I'm not for Sharia law. You know, I'm not for any religion or group or whatever you are if you're going to hurt other people. I mean, that's just
right.
Not tolerated. But have you stopped to think, conservative Christian, of all of the people who were being hurt or die or commit suicide because of the homophobia that's out there,
mm-hmm.
that the Christian church sort of institutionalizes, that, you know, this
mm-hmm.
don't ask, don't tell thing that our military institutionalizes homophobia. I said, what about
mm-hmm.
the Pope going to Africa saying that, you know, talking against condoms, wives can't use condoms in AIDS-ravaged Africa. Look at the people, you know, that are going to have a death sentence because of that. I said,
mm-hmm.
what about those things?
Right.
And I said, well, not only that, but there's a physical death, and I think there's also a death of your spirit and your soul. What about all the women who have been hurt in history,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they've been either burned at the stake or they've been second-class citizens and, you know, haven't been able to reach their fullest potential? What about these Christian groups that are polygamists and they, you know, marry 13-year-old girls who never get
right.
an education? You know, so what about all of these other things, you know, that, in a sense, you know, kill people, you know, with it, so, you know, then they would sort of be quiet,
yeah,
you know, but there is so much damage, you know, being
yeah.
done, you know, in the name of religion. It's unfathomable to me in this sophisticated culture that we live in that so much of it is still so much in denial or backward or, you know, they're just still shackled by these ridiculous beliefs.
I know. It's true. And I guess my take on it is we need to love these. We need to love these people. Christians need to be loved like no one else has ever been loved. But we need also to tell them that they're viewpoints are harming the earth, people on the earth, and that they need to take a good long look at what they're doing. I mean, it's not the people, it's their system, their holy books that are the problem. And,
right. Well, you know, and some people have said, well, you know, if you grow up in a secular world, then it'll just be science who's the master of morality. You know, I don't know. You know, I guess anything, it's anything taken to the extreme. But really, it's so silly because, you know, it just feels like to me if we just employed common sense, you know, or the golden rule. But it's like, you know, those simple ideas, it just seems don't compute anymore.
Well, the golden rule is in a book that also includes 300 verses about making war or torturing people if they don't do what Jehovah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Tell me about that. The golden rule comes from where?
Well, the golden rule comes from the New Testament, and the Old Testament is chock full of verses about war and torturing people and what do you call it when parents eat their children? There are 7 or 8. I couldn't believe this when I found them, but 7 or 8 verses in the Bible about parents cannibalizing their children.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you in your bio there was something about Minoan Crete, right? You said that you spent a month on the island of Crete. And I don't know if when you were there or in studying Crete, did you run across some of that archaeological evidence where they believe they were maybe sacrificing babies? They suspected that it might have been because of the climate change. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, there are some archaeologists who believe that, but other archaeologists say that's really not true, that that people all over the world, in many places in the world, when people die, they dismantle the skeleton and bury the bones separately. And I think that was the evidence that these archaeologists who didn't know anything about anthropology, I think, took to mean this negative stuff that you're talking about. But
I see.
No,
okay.
Yeah, it. I do not believe that
okay.
happened at all.
Well, you know, that sort of went against, intuitively, that didn't feel right to me. And I'm glad you said what you said because I couldn't go there.
No.
It's sort of like with Tanit, too, you know, the goddess Tanit, where they say they have these graveyards of babies. So, you know, you have Christians who say, well, the worshippers of Baal and Baalat were these heathens who sacrificed their children to, you know, these gods that demanded that they did. And, you know, and I can't go there either.
No. It's in the Bible, though, that you get cannibalizing of children. It's just amazing. I mean, my favorite is in 2 Kings, there's a woman goes to the king of Israel and says, my neighbor said to me, give up your son so we may eat him today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son. So we cooked my son and ate him, and the next day I said to her, give up your son so we may eat him, but she had hidden him. So she's going to the king of Israel and saying, this is wrong. Why don't you, you know, shake this woman up and make her fly right, and she needs to hand over her son. The other thing that people get mixed up about is war goddesses and violent goddesses. There were no war goddesses or violent goddesses before war gods came on the scene. I mean, it was war people who turned peaceful goddesses into war goddesses. We have no evidence.
I recall reading something about that, about Inanna Ishtar had been turned into a war goddess, where prior to that she had been sort of the fertility abundance goddess, you know, and then, you know, men who wanted to go to war turned her into a war goddess, which I have a theory, Jerry, and I don't know whether you've thought about this. One theory that I, you know, speaking of the goddess Sekhmet, the only written record about Sekhmet is about her wanton rampage. And you know, and they turned her into a war goddess, even though she's a healer and she's a mother goddess and she's all of those things, too. My, you know, and maybe, you know, this is just a given, but I believe that there must be somewhere other myths of Sekhmet besides that one where she's on this drunken rampage and basically devouring mankind, because to me that's not Sekhmet either. That's it feels like a skewed patriarchal view. You know,
an overlay. Yes, right. Yeah, that happened frequently. Once war began and war gods began, the people who were doing war turned the peaceful goddesses into war goddesses. You can see it everywhere. So
Well, Jerry, we're about out of time. It's been delightful. I so love to speak to someone as knowledgeable about you, because then, you know, I really can ask, you know, questions that have been, you know, sort of niggling at the back of my mind. And I think we can, you know, it really just makes for a much more potent conversation. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Well, you know, I know we've talked about a lot, but is there maybe one other thing that we haven't covered that you think is important and you want to make sure listeners know, or have we covered it just about as much as you think we can?
I can't really think of anything that we haven't covered that I would like to. I know there have to be things, but can't think of anything right now.
You know what? Let me ask you this. Maybe did we miss the most important question? How do we accomplish the switch? Did you have some steps or some ideas?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about education, how people can't see that their gods are war gods, and we have to educate them about that, and they don't know that goddess utopias used to exist. And we need to educate them about that, and most of all talk to our academics and tell them to stop being so deceptive about this prehistoric goddess thing, because they really need to be talked to about that.
Well, you know, we really need our own colleges, quite frankly. I'm about to give a paper at a conference in January, a pagan conference on building community, and I'm sort of in the middle of that. And one of the things I've already written is that we need our own schools. You know, we want to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, but we also want to teach astronomy and astrology and, goddess ideals and ethics and, all of these different, gardening and permaculture and, you know, all of these different things. I just wish we had some wealthy benefactors that could help us, you know, start to grow this kind of new thought.
Karen, that is one of the things that I list in Switching to Goddess in the How Do We Switch chapter, and that is money. We need to gather money, and Jean Shinoda Bolen has written that we're about to experience one of the largest wealth transfers in history. I think it is the largest, she says, because the baby boomers are inheriting from their parents. And since women live longer than men, a lot of this money is going to be transferred into the hands of boomer women. And I think we need to start now starting organizations to collect money for the goddess movement. If we start now, we can build our reputation as being, money organizations who can be trusted and spend the money wisely. So definitely money could go a long way.
And I don't know, maybe you have this in your book too, but, you know, I'm also, not that, I don't know if our current government is sustainable. You know, at some point we might just have to throw it all away and start over again. But it almost
mm-hmm.
seems like we really need to get different kinds of people who think the way we do in Congress, you know. And
yes,
I don't know
yes.
whether that's possible without campaign finance reform, because everybody's beholden to people for money so that they can get reelected, and that seems to be their primary concern rather
mm-hmm.
than being servants of the people. But I don't know. I guess I just wonder if we could get some untouchable women, you know, in the Congress, a lot of them, that believe the way we do, that would sort of stem the tide of this craziness.
Well, given the current situation, I think one of the ways we could start to do that is by building money institutions, organizations that will allow us to collect money to fund politicians, our own politicians,
right.
candidates.
Well,
yeah.
Excuse me. I know one of the things they were saying to help progressives and liberals is we need to have think tanks established the way the conservatives do, and that sort of falls along these lines too. You know, establish think tanks that embrace these ideals.
Definitely.
Oh God, we have so much work to do.
We do. We do.
Oh, well, but you know what? We are multitaskers, and if anybody can do it, it's women.
That's right. That's right. Well, and, you know, if we can light fires under some of the, you know, younger generation coming up and along, then that'll go a long way, because they can take over the load. Help
yeah, carry the
carry
torch.
It. Yeah.
Carry the torch. Excuse me, Jerry. I'm so sorry. I'm surprised I haven't had a cough and fit before now. I've talked more to you in the last hour than I've talked all week.
Oh, my goodness,
but,
yeah.
I've been saving my voice for you.
Yeah.
But it has been wonderful. Thank you so very much. It's been such a delight. And I want you to leave our listeners. Do you have a website or a way anyone could reach you if they wanted to communicate with you? Do you still have your blog going, or
my blog has not been. I haven't been keeping that up as much as I'd like to, and I just really would love to get back to it. But my website is jerrystudebaker.com, and I can spell that if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah.
It's J E R I, and then Studebaker is S-T-U. StudeBaker.com.
Okay.
And,
well, thank you so very much for being on the show. And, of course, anybody can get your book on Amazon or all the regular places, right?
That's right. There are, yes, 10, 15 online bookstores that sell it, and Amazon is one. Yeah.
Okay. And that title again is Switching to Goddess. So thank you so very much, Jerry, for being on the show. And you know what? You're always welcome back anytime.
Oh, thank you, Karen. It's been wonderful talking to you, and thank you for your radio station.
Well, you know what? It's my guilty pleasure. I really enjoy doing it, and you know, I'm happy to be able to give people like you a platform to share the important knowledge that so many of us, you know, we just need to get out there. So thank you, too, for the work you're doing out there as well.
Okay.
All right. Well, good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. Like I say, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks, which we've been talking about tonight, just might save the world. So if you've been listening, that was Jerry Studebaker, author of Switching Goddess, that I've had on for the last 90 minutes, and what so many of us goddess advocates are doing today, because you know, we know ideals of the great she, the great mother, you know, the work of people like Jerry and the information she has in her book. Well, you know, that just provides the roadmap to help us save humanity and our planet. So So it's about that time when we are across the threshold into the next part of the show. But I do need to take a very quick break, and then I'm going to be back with the What's the Buzz segment. I actually have a lot of interesting stuff, some feedback from you, the listeners, some articles that I want to share with you. So please stay with me, and in about 60 seconds, I'll be back to start What's the Buzz. And for this minute here, I'm going to leave you listening to Breath of Passion by Zingaya. We're going to get into our What's the Buzz segment. Let's start off with Cherry Hill Seminary. I wonder if you know about Cherry Hill Seminary, and I just want to make sure you do. Cherry Hill Seminary, they call it Distance Education for Pagan Ministry, and they're doing a wonderful job out there educating, you know, pagans to be ministers. And they're registering now for spring 2011. They have lots of courses coming up. They have master's degree programs on things like ethics and boundaries, liturgical design, beyond the wheel of the year, introduction to pagan theology, goddess traditions, history of alternative healing in America, earth congregations, nature as a classroom, stress, trauma, self-care for the pagan counselors. They also have some four-week courses to increase knowledge, like pagan elders and ancestors, focusing on Dionne Fortune or Doreen Valiente, why magical thinking isn't crazy, sacred Egypt, sacred sciences, sacred nourishment. And a friend of mine, a scholar over at California State University of Northridge here in California, she is going to be teaching a folklore, culture, and authenticity in modern paganism class. And that's going to be part of the Cherry Hill Seminary Winter Conference, and that's going to be held at Pantheacon in San Jose in February. So anyway, if you want to know more about Cherry Hill Seminary, if you've been thinking about teaching or if you've been thinking about increasing your own knowledge to maybe feel more confident out there in the world, you know, if you're a pagan minister, go to cherryhillseminary.org. I think you will be pleasantly impressed with what they're doing over there. Also, too, if you're in the Costa Mesa, California area, that's Southern California, I wanted you to know that on Saturday, December 18th, there is going to be a screening of Svetlana's Journey, and it benefits a project called Hearts for Haiti. And first of all, let me tell you, Svetlana's Journey is about human trafficking. It talks, you know, it gets into the horror of human slavery, and the film is the actual story of a teenage girl given up to traffickers by her own family, and it shows, you know, what life for young women like that, you know, what their life is like. You know, because if you know, you're interested in goddess spirituality, well, we believe women's rights are human rights, and these are causes that we support and issues we discuss and try to shed light on and hope that one day we can curtail such atrocities. Because, you know, human trafficking is not something that just happens in third world countries. You know, recently a young girl was rescued from a prominent family in Laguna Beach, California, a wealthy Laguna Beach, Southern California family, who obtained this young Egyptian girl to be in servitude to the family. Well, they got caught because neighbors thought something was suspicious when the little girl never seemed to leave the house or go to school. Also, it may or may not come as a surprise to you that women are often employed, and maybe employed is not the right word, they're forced into sex trafficking at high-profile sports events like the Super Bowl. And, you know, there are places right here in downtown Los Angeles that are sex trafficking prisons. I mean, there may be one in your local hometown, too. So getting back to Svetlana's journey, there's a screening of that movie that's going to happen at the UU Church in Costa Mesa on Saturday the 18th, and it's going to benefit Hearts for Haiti. And what Hearts for Haiti is a woman by the name of Sandy Kirkpatrick. She's actually going to be making her third trip to Haiti to try to rescue people who have been human trafficked, and any money they raise at this event is going to go toward helping her accomplish that goal and to help you know, rehabilitate any people that that they may they may actually be able to rescue. So you can go to my Examiner column and read more about this and get information about where exactly, you know, this is all taking place. My Examiner column is L.A. Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner. If you just go to the Examiner Los Angeles and put in my name in the search box, my writings will come up, or go to my website, KarenTate.com. Right on the first page, there's a link to my Examiner column. Also, too, on my Examiner column right now is a new article called The Christian Lens, Why Goddess-Worshipping Greeks Had No Pornography. And that's there, compliments of a returning guest blogger, Dr. David Hillman, author of The Chemical Muse. Well, David is just hot off a wildly successful presentation at Boston University. You might remember him. He's a self-proclaimed servant of the Muses. He's a supporter of women and goddess advocates everywhere. His scholarly discoveries and research, which were once censored by academia, are now coveted by them, because a lot of them are realizing the error in their thinking and have started to begin to enthusiastically embrace his body of work. So anyway, you might be one of the first to want to read the latest of what may be no doubt controversial to some people, but textually sound. And please read it. Feel free to leave your comments. And the title of that piece, again, was The Christian Lens, Why Goddess-Worshipping Greeks Had No Pornography. So you can find that on my Examiner column as well that just went up today. I also want to tell you, if you're the type of person that plans ahead, I am going to be teaching the curriculum Rise Up and Call Her Name at the Goddess Temple starting in March. The Goddess Temple is in Irvine, California. And you might recall, if you're a regular listener, I taught Cakes for the Queen of Heaven last year, and this year it'll be the Rise Up and Call Her Name curriculum. And if you haven't heard of it before, it's a woman-honoring journey into global earth-based spiritualities. It's also described as a multicultural experiential curriculum that provides participants with a unique view of international religious imagery and worldviews. The course study, structured as a spiritual
spiritual journey around the globe has been used by thousands of people. In fact, just last week we had Elizabeth Fisher on the show. She's actually the author of the program. And it exposes students to a variety of religious practices and beliefs worldwide that honor the earth and the feminine divine. And it's both eye-opening and enriching. It's a 13-class course, and we're going to be doing two a month starting in March. So if you want more information about that, you can email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com, or just go to my website, and you will find a link there that tells you, that you can click on that'll instantly email me. I also wanted to share something with you that I got from Lady Olivia Robertson. You may know who she is. She's one of the founders of the International Fellowship of ISIS. I've been a member of that organization for a long time, going back to the early 90s, when Lady Olivia actually invited me to Clonakilty Castle in Ireland to be ordained as a priestess of the Sacred Feminine. And I just recently got a letter from her that I wanted to share with you. It came around the time of Thanksgiving, and it felt so perfectly timed. And it just made me feel so good. You know, if you're a regular listener, you know I always talk about appreciating feedback because it's gas in my tank. Keeps me going. Because, you know, most of what I do, you know, there's no monetary compensation. It's really about being in service and, you know, trying to, help shift worldviews so that, people have a better way of life. And so anyway, to be acknowledged by somebody like Lady Olivia felt really good. It just really, it was beautiful. Anyway, this is what she said. My dear Karen, what a wonderful letter I had written her to tell her about an ordination I was doing. And she says, forgive the delay, but I've just returned from England, Glastonbury, Wiltshire, Crop Circles, viewing all of those beautiful sites. Truly, you have fulfilled, more than fulfilled, all the hopes I had for your priestly ministry that I felt here at Clonakilty Castle. You have within you the divine spark alight, which gives you energy rising above all the detriments to go on with what you believe in despite all the odds. Do give my love and blessings to the new priestesses who have come to ISIS through your own ordinations, and believe truly ISIS will return for us in 2012. Love and blessings of ISIS, Olivia. So, anyway, I just wanted to share that with you out there, and thank you, Lady Olivia, and thanks to my listeners who write me so often and thank me for the radio show. It really does make a difference to know that it's making a difference and it's meaningful to people. Also, some feedback from last week. You might recall I mentioned an article that I wrote for Thanksgiving. It was about basically how we've sort of sanitized American history, and we don't really talk about what was really going on with the Puritans and the Native Americans, and how horrendous that was for the indigenous people. And in response to that article on the Examiner, which again you can find right there, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, I had Candace Ross write in, and she says, Dear Karen, what was done to the Native peoples was deplorable. I am all for remaking holidays and, like you, have developed new rituals. Before becoming pagan, I had come to call holidays hollow days, H-O-L-L-O-W, hollow days, for they held little meaning for me. Thanksgiving for me is now a day to ponder the abundance and beauty Mother Earth bestows on us and realize how truly blessed we are. It has become a day not to gorge on turkey, but to reflect on the miracle of life and the wonder of our journey.
on quite another subject, though not yet not really. I have thought for many years what we need is a national day of shame, a day to speak about all the inexcusable things our nation has done, to seek forgiveness, and to vow not to allow such things to ever happen again. Love and blessings, Candace. Thank you, Candace. I couldn't agree with you more. I have most definitely felt the holidays being very hollow, and I am all for that National Day of Shame, because you know what? I'm really, really tired of so many people just living in denial about all of the atrocities, you know, going on everywhere. Also, too, inspiration from last week, we had Jeanette Clancy on the show. She's the author of God Is Not Two Guys in the Sky. Three Guys, sorry, God Is Not Three Guys in the Sky. Excuse me. Well, we had a wonderful conversation about progressive Christian thinking, and we found so much common ground, and we really just clicked and connected, and I personally told her I think the nuns should mutiny and take over the church. Anyway, she was inspired after after our interview to write a sermon to Catholic priests on her blog, and I wanted to just make sure you knew about it in case you wanted to go read it, because you know what, just Jerry and I were saying, you know, the moderates out there, the progressives out there, you know, in these Abrahamic faiths, well, you know, they need to be speaking up like this brave Jeanette Clancy, you know, telling these Catholic priests that that they contribute to sex abuse every time they say Mass by reciting typical liturgical God talk. And, you know, this actually drew a lot of fire for Jeanette, but, you know, she is standing in her strength. She's standing in her power because she knows she's right. So anyway, I just wanted to remind you again about her blog. She could use some support there. She would love to hear from you, I'm sure. And it is called, again, GodIsNotThreeGuys.com. And she has some other articles there you might want to look at, because here she is, a progressive Catholic who is in favor of abortion. She believes that abortion should not be something that's taken away from women. So anyway, you can read about that, and she talks about what it's like to be a pro-choice Catholic. So anyway, you know, these are the kinds of people that Goddess Advocates can definitely find common ground with. And I don't know, I don't think I'd be going too far out on a limb to say Jeanette Clancy could probably identify with being a Goddess Advocate. I think our values are really very much in sync if we just took away the labels. Still on the theme of Thanksgiving, I wanted to read you something that the Goddess Temple of Orange County put out. And this came out for Thanksgiving Day, but you know what? It's something that we can actually think about any day. And this was sort of their Thanksgiving Day prayer to their congregation, and it goes like this. On this Thanksgiving Day, we are grateful for our sisterhood in this temple community. We are grateful for our ancestresses from whose female bodies we were birthed and upon whose shoulders we stand now. We are grateful for our holy female bodies, the primary form of the human being, from which our sacred wombs give forth life, continuing the human race. We are grateful for the mothers who have birthed the next generation of human beings into the world and who will raise them in families filled with love, patience, and wisdom. We are grateful for the wise and good men who use their divine powers to protect, defend, and support all life, working for the good of all alongside their queens. We are grateful for those known as Two Spirits, and by many other names, for the sacred knowing that they hold for humanity. We are grateful for the magical beings known as animals, for the beauty, life, force, and messages they bring to those who will receive and listen. We are grateful for the plant, mineral, and water realms for their nourishments, giving to us humans what we need to live. We are grateful for our many strong and generous members who contribute financially that this temple may continue to serve us all. We are grateful for the many wise female teachers who touch and teach this community. We are grateful for our Naiad priestesses who give so much to help to create beauty and sacred space every week. We are grateful for First Priestess and Temple Operations Director Morrigan, who devotedly serves and leads within the community. We are grateful for the strong awareness of the divine within, which keeps us in ancient natural female spiritual authority, as we women all over Mother Earth hold the entire world of human beings together with our powers, the power of the maiden to bring freshness to life, the power of the mother to create, birth, and nurture life, the power of the queen to lead like water, holding reverence for life as the standard for all, and the power of the wise woman crone for peaceful prayer, deep magic, and timeless wisdom. Thank you, Goddess. And that comes from Ava, the providing priestess and center holder, founder of the Goddess Temple of Orange County. And, this was an article I wanted to share with you from a column called Truth Out that I get on the internet, truth-out.org. They were giving thanks to citizens and grassroots progressives. The article sort of stresses what, you know, corporations just don't get. They were saying this Thanksgiving, progressive Americans can find plenty to be grateful for, and they were talking about the Girl Scouts of America as an example. Well, the Girl Scouts were seeking new bids for the manufacture of uniforms and sashes worn by the almost 3 million girls who are members of the Girl Scouts of America. And their uniforms were usually done by a company in New Jersey, but they weren't going to be able to do it anymore. So the Girl Scouts were thinking about sending the work offshore to China because they were going to get the uniforms cheaper. Well, they stopped and they thought about it and they said, well, there's value, but then there are values. And what the Girl Scouts decided to do was to do the right thing. And they started thinking, well, what values are we teaching our girls if we're going to take jobs from Americans and, ship the work over to China just to get the uniforms cheaper? They say, if you want ethically compromised value, go to Walmart. But they said that they want to promote good values among the Girl Scouts. So it only took 2 days for the headquarters to change their position and quickly modify that in order to put in a bid, the manufacturer had to be a U.S. manufacturer, and they had to have manufacturing guidelines for the age and treatment of workers. So indeed, officials turned a bad position into a positive lesson. And we thank the many Girl Scout advocates who stood up for their beliefs and showed that every voice makes a difference. And even though the media mavens don't cover it, grassroots progressives are forging surprising coalitions in places such as Iowa, Houston, Syracuse, Missouri, New Haven, Ohio, Rhode Island. All across the country, people are producing new solutions and structural changes that add up to real hope for shared prosperity in America. In big and small, there's much we can be thankful for and build on. So, the point here is that real change is up to us. It can't all come from President Obama or the Democratic Party. They are not the progressive movement. We are, you and I, we have to be activists. We have to be innovators. We have to do what we can in our little part of the world to help change things. And you can find action right where you live to start putting progress back in into a progressive mode or direction so that it doesn't continue to regress. Well, it's about time to say goodnight for another week. I hope you'll be back with me next Wednesday. I have on the show Andrea Riggs. We're going to talk about her book, Wake Up American Women, Writing Women Back into History. That should be a lot of fun. And excuse me. So to close the show tonight, we're going to shift gears for a minute here, and we're going to go to our evening prayer or affirmation to just sort of close the show on a little bit of a spiritual note. So I invite you to sort of shake off all the things we've been talking about and focus your attention within. Connect with your divine goddess self. Close your eyes, take a deep breath. Let our consciousness begin to shift. Focus on our connection with the Divine Mother. Dear Goddess, let a renaissance of Earth Goddess religion lead us to a new age of enlightenment. May love and wisdom guide us in building a multicultural world culture civilization based on respect and cooperation instead of greed and predation. Let the rebirth of Mother Goddess world culture be the new world order. The peace of Goddess is expressing in me. Divinely guided, I move with confidence and compassion. I claim my innate health, wholeness, and beauty. I live in an abundant universe where there is enough for everyone. I seek peace. I speak peace. I live from a peaceful heart. Well, listeners, let me say, may we all find our voice and use it in whatever ways we can. Let us be her sacred roar. Good night, and thanks for tuning in. Hope you'll be back next Wednesday at 6 o'clock Pacific time.